RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Simon Elmer, welcome back to Reality Check Radio. Nice to have you back.
Hello, Paul. Nice to have us. Thank you for having me back on. I'm looking forward to chatting with you again.
Now, we've got a bit to talk about, and maybe you've got a bit of admin to do before we start talking.
Yeah. we've never had to do this before, haven't we? But I think it's something that almost everyone's going to have to do from now on. You've probably heard that there have been a massive arrests of people who are demonstrating over the last few weeks about what's been going on in the UK. But particularly, there's been this new thing of, it's not completely new, but it's the level of it, of arrests being made for remarks or comments made online, particularly on Twitter or social media. And it's being done under the Online Safety Act, which came into UK law last year. And under Section 179 of this Act, a person commits an offence if they send a message, or in this case, convey information on a discussion like this. If the person knows this information to be false, and at the time of sending it, that person intends the message or the information in it to cause, this is what it says in the law, non-trivial psychological or physical harm to a likely audience. So I should just have a caveat to this. Under the very next section, Section 180, recognise new publishers, which includes over here the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, licensed broadcasters and all mainstream media outlets cannot commit an offence under Section 179. So this legally absolves them from publishing what they might know to be misinformation. Anyway, Orwellian as this may seem, I've got to start this conversation by saying that all the data in this article that we'll be talking about, which I've researched, has been published by the Office for National Statistics, the Ministry of Justice, the British Transport Police, the House of Commons Library, and other news publishers recognised under the Online Safety Act 2023. So therefore, to the best of my knowledge, it is accurate and not false. And in talking about it with you, making it known, my intent is merely to make known to the British public the data about UK immigration, which I think a lot of us feel, well, it definitely is the case, is not being made available. Now, from this data, I draw some tentative, but I think logical conclusions. And unlike the government, I invite, or the media, I invite the reader or the listener to interrogate and challenge these conclusions. By doing so, I do not intend to cause non-trivial psychological, physical harm to any listening audience. And nor do I have any reason to think that talking about this data or any conclusions we might draw from this would cause such harm. So that's my kind of legal disclaimer, which I think more and more people are going to have to start making in the future.
That blows me away, Simon. That just blows me away, man. It's got to this. It's got to this. We'll get into all of it in just a moment. I want to ask you about, did Orwell talk about English fascism? He had a particular description for the English version. Has it arrived?
Yeah. In a book he published in 1937 called The Road to Wigan Pier, it's in two parts, and it's known for the first part where he sort of travels through the mining towns of the UK, of the England, during the Great Depression. And it's basically an exposure of the kind of appalling conditions that the English working class were living under at the time. But in the second part of the book, he writes about English socialism and the threat of English fascism. You know, this is when Oswald Mosley was put in England and so on, and obviously got fascism in both Italy, had been for a long time, and also in Germany. And he makes some speculations about the possibility of an English fascism. And he makes a number of interesting quotes. He says kind of amusing things like, when English fascism arrives here, it's likely to be a slimy, anglicized form.
Yeah.
I think your New Zealand listeners would appreciate that.
That rings a bell already.
Yeah, and if you look at Keir Starmer, you know, he's a pretty slimy, anglicized form, isn't he? He says that instead of Nazi thugs, we'll have cultured policemen, which to me evokes images of, you know, the police forces going around carrying rainbow flags and all this sort of stuff. And he says instead of the swastika, we'll have the lion and the unicorn. He also says something very interesting, I think, which is more not just humorous. He says he can imagine a middle class, an English middle class, ground down into poverty, still being violently anti-working class in its sentiments. And he says this is a ready-made fascist party. We have to remember that the fascist parties in Germany and Italy and across Europe, because by then they'd taken power in many, many places, were generally drawn from the petite bourgeoisie, as we called them back then, kind of the lower middle classes. Mm. I think, you know, this across the world, the middle classes are being ground down. Their standard of living is falling, lowered. And the kind of support that we have for the measures that are being introduced on the back of the disturbances that we saw over the last couple of weeks in the UK are almost universally supported by this kind of narrow tranche of the middle class. You have to remember, if we can just mind your readers, your listeners, Keir Starmer, our new prime minister, was elected by only 20% of the UK electorate on the smallest turnout in an election, I think maybe ever, certainly in a very long time. But he's only been voted for by a small 20%. He's been voted for on the back of, I guess, policies which you could broadly describe as globalist and as woke. He's been a supporter over the last few years of everything that the opposition, the Conservative government did, whether that was lockdown, the vaccine program, the support for the proxy war in the Ukraine, and also for the genocide that's going on in Gaza. This tranche of people have looked at him and said, no, we still want you in. Usually on the back of no more than things like, let's get the Tories out. That means the Conservative government, which is about the level of politics over here. So he doesn't really have a mandate from the British people. And I think that's slightly behind the really authoritarianism of his actions over the last month.
Yeah, because I think myself and also our listeners who have been following, and by the way, you're probably not going to be surprised to know, Simon, that there really hasn't been too much coverage of the last few weeks, particularly in the UK, here in our mainstream media. So many people will not be aware. But to see Keir Starmer talking tough, a lot of us were wondering, who are you talking to? Who's the audience? I think you've just described them, have you?
Yeah, Keir Starmer's every time he's interviewed, it's become a sort of a joke over here. He mentions that he's the son of a toolmaker, and he kind of claims that he's got this working class background. Although famously, he was actually asked what defines working class, and he could not come up with an answer. Mm. He's nothing of the kind. He used to be the head of the Crown Prosecution Service, so he knows the police force very, very well. He was in that job for many years. He's a lawyer. He's a policeman, in effect. But he's also a real establishment figure. He's a member of the UK's Privy Council. That's someone who's got direct access to the sovereign, the king, because, as you remember, we still have a king over here as a head of state. he's also a member of the Trilateral Commission, which is this strange invitation-only group, which kind of has its fingers in all sorts of pots across the world. So he is an establishment figure. I think he's been carefully picked to do the job that he's about to do. One of the most, I think, revealing interviews with Starmer, because he's been kind of expected to occupy this position as our new prime minister for a long time. I think it was last year or maybe the year before, he was asked by an interviewer, a UK interviewer, whether he preferred or had allegiance to Westminster, i.e. the UK Parliament and the whole political process, or Davos, which is the meeting place, the annual meeting place of the World Economic Forum. And he said without hesitation, Davos, which I think was a absolutely extraordinary declaration. This is a man who's trying to attain office and power through a mandate, through a democratic process of election. He's first of all elected as an MP by his local constituents, then as leader of the Labour Party, and now as Prime Minister of the UK. He's not elected to represent what's going on in the people who make up the World Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum is a think tank of, I guess, global capitalism. Its membership is made up of about 1,200 of the most powerful corporations in the world, information technology companies, in particular, banks and financial institutions. And yet, without hesitation, he said, no, I prefer this. If we had any accountability in our media, or if our media held our politicians to account, I thought that would be the end of his political career. But it wasn't, not at all. We've come to accept, I think, over the last few years. Paul, when was the last time you heard the word democracy used? We used to have it sort of shoved down our
throats every conversation. Time, but I don't hear it applied in the historical context that I've kind of come to think of it.
Over here, I can't remember the last time I've heard it discussed, actually. The US uses it when about to invade someone, but it doesn't get discussed over here. And I think more and more, there is a kind of a political landscape of emerging where the idea of having a mandate and being elected democratically and being held and being accountable to the people who elect you is not the framework in which governments are operating anymore. They're very, very open about working with what are transnational technocracies, whether that's the United Nations, the European Commission, the World Economic Forum, or the World Health Organization, and that it's through them that they're acting. And also, I think it's getting to the point where they're admitting that they're actually representing these bodies.
Hmm.
Under the kind of the excuse that, you know, we're facing global issues and therefore we need a kind of a global response to it. So, to answer your question, who's he talking to? I think he's talking
to
two
audience?
People. I think he's to go back to the point about what Orwell said about English fascism. Fascism rules by fear. I think a lot of the videos he's releasing, he released one where he was in a police command center with screens all over the walls, basically spying on the British people. It's an incredibly, sort of police state, surveillance state sort of representation. And I've never seen any prime minister of the UK represent himself in this, making these threats that we're going to find you and we're going to track you down. I think a lot of this is bluff. I think a lot of it is you can't arrest millions and millions of people. So I think it's a threat. You know, there's been a video going around of a magistrate, perhaps, handing down declarations to people who've been arrested under these relatively new laws, either for being present at a demonstration, participating in any kind of criminal damage, but also making specifically online statements, which the government has judged to be incitements to violence, the kind of sort of thing that I started this with. Now, you can't film inside a court. So these are probably staged scenes.
Yeah.
And I think in all this, I think we have to be careful with all of this because the reaction that's been provoked or that has formed around these incidents, very few of us have been present in any of these, where this is all being mediated through social media. So when we see scenes online of police saying to, groups that we're here to defend you or to others that we're going to attack you, we have to think about that all this is being mediated through the social media. Every government that exists in the world at the moment knows the power of social media. A lot of what's happening at the moment is their wish to control what gets said on social media and to crack down on people who are trying to reveal something beyond it. I think he's chosen very carefully to represent himself as a very authoritarian police-like figure who is going to absolutely crack down, not just on what the government has decided is hate speech, but in some of the statements they've made, they're saying, it's hard to believe this, but nothing is unbelievable these days. Anyone who is attacks the establishment, which is a strange sort of term to use.
Yeah. You mentioned the Online Safety Act, Section 179. I think you went on to also mention Section 180. And that gives an out to the mainstream broadcasters. Did I hear that right?
Yeah. It says specifically that recognized news publishers, so broadcasters and mainstream media outlets, including the British Broadcasting Corporation, which really dominates the media here, it says that they cannot commit an offence under Section 179. So there's specifically the legislation that's made, which means that I or you or anyone else commits an offence under Section 179 does not apply to 180.
Well, that's the quiet part out loud, isn't it, right there?
Yeah, I mean, when this came out, people on social media started sort of pointing out the enormous number of statements that have been made by members of this government, particularly the cabinet, which have quite clearly been false over the last 4 years. One of the most biggest which is that the so-called vaccinations, the gene therapies, the vaccination program was the phrase we used in this country, I imagine across the world, was safe and effective. At the moment, I think we've got something like 14,000 legal, not demands, but applications for compensation for damage from the vaccination program being made in the UK alone. And I imagine that's the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
So they've definitely covered themselves from the huge range of knowingly false statements, which are definitely likely to cause or have caused far more than simply psychological, but also physical harm. I mean, declaring that lockdown was a medical measure lockdown hasn't been used as a medical measure since, I think, the 17th century in Europe. And it caused immense damage economically, physically, definitely psychologically. And yet we were told by doctors, politicians, and particularly those in power now, that this was something which would actually make the situation better. It made it infinitely worse. So I think they're aware of that in advance before passing the Online Safety Safety Act. And they deliberately covered themselves from that.
I want to get on to the policing shortly, but the background of all of this, I think we're aware that immigration is kind of one of the drivers of this. And there's the UN Immigration Replacement Report that I think you've used to do analysis on numbers. Can you tell us about that report and what the numbers show? Is there a there in terms of immigration? You know, is it the driver, the main driver, if you really wind it back to an origin?
I don't think it's the driver of what's going on. I think the huge increase in immigration, not just in the UK, but across Europe, the US, and to the West in general, I think that's a cause of what's behind it. But it's very clear from this report that this is not something which is casually happening. It is direct policy. Do you want to start with it? We could start with the report if you'd like. The report was... Just go down to here.
Sure.
The report was published in the year 2000 by the United Nations. Again, one of these transnational technocracies, which is having more and more influence, control over our life. It was published in the year 2000. And what it wanted to address was something which is a reality, particularly across the West, which is both a declining population in Western countries, and in particular, an aging population. And it's a kind of an accountant's report on how we address this. And what it's concerned with the increasing imbalance between the working age population and the elderly and retired population, and how the former can support the latter. You know, this is happening across the world. You know, I'm living in China at the moment now. I think Shanghai is going to have something like 30% of its population being over the age of 65, you know, by the end of the decade. And this creates a problem. what it comes up with is various scenarios. It's got five different scenarios. I won't go into them. But the most extreme scenario five, and it looks at all, you know, most European countries, Germany, Italy, but also looks at Japan. It looks at the UK, obviously, the US. And it also looks at Russia. I don't think it does you, from what I can see, mate. And it comes up with what kind of levels of immigration do we need in order to maintain this balance between a working age population and a retired population. Now, implicit in all of this is that seeing as a possible answer to this is to increase the standard of living of the working age population. They don't want to increase the taxes that the government will have to put on the population, and also, obviously, because a lot of taxes come out of the corporate sector of a population. They don't want to increase taxes on the corporate sector in order to, to meet the increased burden of an elderly population. They want to keep the status quo, at least, in terms of relationship between the corporate sector and the tax paid by the workers of a country. Now, if we just focus on the UK, the extreme scenario for the UK is for the UK to have more than 1 million migrants a year on average between 1995 and 2050, that by 2050, which is, it's not too long ago now, too far away now, is it? It's two and a half decades. The UK would have 59.8 million immigrants by 2050, that our population would have increased to 136 million, out of which 80 million, that is 59%, would be made up of post 1995 migrants and their descendants.
Wow.
Now, it's got similar figures. It's got very similar figures for Europe, for the US, and all these other countries. So a mass immigration program. And most importantly, I think, and this is, you know, why people are so worried about this, it means that, for instance, if you have children in the UK now, if I had, I don't actually have children in the UK, but if I had children in the UK, by the time they come to adults, they're going to be an ethnic minority in their own country.
Hmm.
A lot of people say, why does that matter? I guess we're seeing why it matters at the moment. You know, I think it was last year, I wrote an article called Woke Racism and the Great Reset. And I looked specifically at how this sort of discourse of racism was being used to push through various programs and legislation of the Great Reset. And the figures I looked at ended at 2021, when the last census was done in the UK. When this started happening recently, I sort of, you know, as I said to you before, I came back from China to the UK for the summer. And I kind of entered into this summer of madness. And I started looking at immigration levels since then. And specifically since 2021, which you might think a weird time because we were still under lockdown, immigration has exponentially increased. It's gone through the absolute roof since then. You have to remember we've just had Brexit in 2016. It came into effect in 2020. And since then, immigration from the European Union, which is where previously most of the immigration came in, most of the immigrants came in into the UK, particularly from Eastern Europe, is now at a negative. There are more people emigrating than coming in. So there's been a new source of immigration, and this has come from primarily, well, in the top 10, 8 countries. These countries are Nigeria, Pakistan, Zimbabwe, Ghana, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and India. Also China as well. But let me just quote you these figures. Between 2021 and 2023, just over this 3-year period, 670,000 Indians, 310,000 Nigerians, 166,000 Pakistanis, 59,000 Zimbabweans, and so on. From those 7 countries alone, there has been 1.369 million immigrants in just 3 years. Now, according to these figures come from the Office of National Statistics, so they're as accurate as they can possibly be. That's about the size of half the population of Birmingham, which is the second largest city in the UK. The Office of National Statistics says that this is expected to continue at a rate of about between 600,000 and 700,000 immigrants per year into the UK for the foreseeable future. That's about the size, I don't know if you've ever been to the UK, it's about the size of Glasgow. Yeah, it's a city of housing and also the infrastructure for it. And this, you know, when I published these figures, I was amazed by these figures. People have been sort of absolutely blown away by them. I've been blown away by them as well. I don't think we've not been told by our media, certainly by our government, the actual level of immigration, but it's clearly being felt. When you let a mass of people the size of the city Glasgow into a country which has only got 68 million population, it is going to be felt. We don't need to the statistics to do it. What I think the UN document reveals is that this is policy. This isn't something that's out of control. We've got this sort of discourse here called stop the boats. You might have heard of it.
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Every time immigration comes up in Parliament or the media or anywhere else, it gets divided into this very silly discourse of, are you racist or are you not racist? And if you're not racist, you want to let people in. If you are racist, you want to stop the boats. And there's this perception that the people coming into the country are coming in illegally, that they're coming through these small boats which come over from Calais in France, and they kind of land on these beaches. And there's a lot of footage going around of this being seen all the time. And it creates this perception in the British public, it has created it, that somehow this is something illegal, this is something which is out of our control. This is something that governments need to get a kind of a hold on with new legislation and tough powers. That is not what's happening at all. Last year, about 80,000 people came to this country on asylum as asylum seekers. 423,000 came on work permits and with their dependents, and about another 389, I haven't got the figures right before me here, came on study permits as well. Now, most of the people coming studying here, they seem to be returning, not all of them, but a lot of them return to the countries they've come from. They get an education here and then go back. Or at least they get a certificate of education anyway.
Yeah.
But the workers, the people coming here on work permits, they stay here. And we've also got, I think last year we had about 75,000 family members of immigrants who had already come here coming over to join them. So this is not something which is out of the government's control. This is not something which is happening illegally. It's not something that, you know, border police need to get tough on. This is UK policy. And it would appear from the UN document that it's policy which has been set by these transnational technocracy, who is telling us how many people we need to have into this country in order to maintain this balance of between a working population and a retired population, but also between a working population and the profits of the people employing them. Now, the trouble with this, sorry, go on.
No. I was going to say, and there's the political establishment is prepared to follow that policy and completely change the face of the country. It seems incredible.
Well, at the current levels, by 2015, the native population of the UK, people born here, will undoubtedly be a minority in their own country. Yeah. And I think that's going to happen across most Western countries, because it seems that this is the UN document. What I think is interesting is, you know, this is a United Nations document. A lot of people have seen it. And it corroborates this idea, this among Western countries, that the people are being replaced in their own country. Now, you've probably heard of this. I'd heard of it as well, that there's something called the Great Replacement.
Yeah,
and
heard of that.
It's denounced on Wikipedia as, this is the quote, as a white nationalist, far-right conspiracy theory. It turns out it's not a conspiracy theory at all. It's actually a United Nations policy. Let me just get this. Despite the evidence of this, the evidence both of the document itself and that it's this which is determining UK and also Western immigration policy, in March of this year, the UN, so the same body that published this and is implementing this, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, he's an Austrian lawyer, Ulfiko Türk. He was personally appointed to the position by the UN Secretary General. He described the Great Replacement theory as a conspiracy theory. We've heard that again, obviously.
Yeah.
But he also went on to call it delusional, racist, as a war on woke, as a war on inclusion. And he also said, and this is the really threatening point, this is where he joins hands with Keir Starmer, who himself, of course, is a lawyer. He says it directly influences perpetrators of violence. So you and I, by talking about this, of talking about this idea, which is not an idea, but which is a policy, which the data supplied by the governments back up, we, by discussing this, are perpetrating violence. And he finally asserted that, something which is not true, that multiculturalism is the history of humanity. In the UK, the kind of levels of, well, not now, but even when immigration began to increase to large numbers, didn't begin until 1948. And even then, it was kind of tiny figures to what we're seeing now. The dangerous thing, I think, for us is the sort of rhetoric describing what is obviously a policy document. I mean, this man is lying. He's quite clearly lying. And yet he's one of the most senior lawyers in the United Nations. That's the sort of rhetoric you're used to hearing from, you know, people on demonstrations holding up placards saying, refugees welcome here, you know, we must smash the far right, anyone who imposes immigration is a racist. But this is being repeated by a very senior jurist at the United Nations. And I think the fact that he's threatening, he's basically making a veiled threat, or not so veiled threat, that anyone who discusses this is inciting violence and therefore can be arrested on a charge of hate crimes and prosecuted under this legislation. I think this is a measure of how much the people behind this, the United Nations and also the national governments which are implementing it, how forcibly they want to bury this document and bury these ideas. And it's for that reason that it's very important that we talk about them. This is policy, it is happening. And the thing about this UN paper is it's, as I said, I described it as an accountant's balancing act to address the threat to the profits of the international corporate sector. It doesn't take account of the cultural, social, and political consequences of mass immigration to such an extent that native populations are actually going to be replaced in their own country in a very short period of time. And that's what we kind of, what's the fallout we're seeing now. And when we think about Keir Starmer's, in this country, his reaction to this, you know, he just went to Northern Ireland.
I've seen his comments,
And he denounced, you know, the entire Irish people effectively as racist for being concerned about these levels of immigration into the country. In the Republic of Ireland, it's even worse. I mean, it's quite extraordinary over there, and there's an enormous amount of concern over there. This is how our leaders are going to respond to this. They're going to crack down on us, and they're going to describe anyone who wants to even discuss this as racist, but more importantly, as inciting violence.
Yeah, which is a pass to do anything in response. Totally get that. Is there a link then, and that's really great information, thank you. Is there a link then with increasing crime? Because that seems to be a perception as well. And, of course, there have been those terrible acts of, murder. I don't need to describe them specifically. They're too traumatic to talk about, actually. But you know what I'm talking about. Is that a perception, or has the crime rate gone up with the immigration rate? Is there anything there?
Yeah, there is. I was looking at, this is the next thing you have to kind of research. This is a parallel set of figures. And this is when we get into dangerous territory, because you remember under lockdown, or when the vaccine program was wheeled out across the world, and people started to see the damages it was causing, the response of the government and the media was this thing called correlation without causality.
Yeah,
there's a correlation between deaths following vaccination with these experimental gene therapies, but you could not prove causality. So I'm going to present these figures, and I think it's up to listeners, other people, to say whether there's definitely a correlation. Is there a causality? I think I'll leave it up to our lawyers to decide that, because I don't want to get myself into trouble. I think one of the most interesting figures I saw, in 2004, the government of Tony Blair, our new Labour government, who really kick-started, when he came in 1997, he formed a government in 1997, immigration in this country was about 50,000 a year. It immediately increased to about 150,000 and sat at that point. Most of that was coming from the European Union. In 2004, not all of it, obviously we've always had large amounts of immigrants from India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and so on. In 2004, the European Union was opened up to Eastern Europe as well. That is, seven countries from Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, etc. They were then given the right to come and work in the UK, and a large number arrived. Between that period, 2004 and 2013, crime in the UK actually lowered. It actually went down. So there's absolutely no correspondence there between immigration and crime. I think at the moment we've got something like 860,000 Poles or something like this in here. Now, interestingly, all these countries, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Slovenia, they've all got a crime rate less than the UK. It's actually lower, which might have surprised a lot of people, but it actually is. Since 2013, though, crime rates in the UK have consistently gone up. One of the things is, I'd said before that since 2016, there has been an emigration of European Union nationals out of the UK, and this has been compensated for by the government by opening up the UK to immigration from what are all these countries I mentioned, those seven countries. They're all part of the Commonwealth, which is kind of a legacy of the British Empire. You're part of that. Sorry, of course you are, mate. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Last time we looked.
So they got the right. They got the right to come here and also to vote here as well, interestingly. So it's going to change the political landscape as well. Yeah. The Brexit was not exclusively, but the decision, this referendum to leave the European Union, which was taken by the British people, it was largely voted for about the concern about immigration. And the government has responded not only by shutting down immigration or reducing it drastically, they've actually about trebled it. Immigration has about trebled since then. and they're coming from different countries, and they're coming from countries with much higher crime rates. So the crime rate in the UK is 1.148. This is the homicide rate, 100,000 people. In places like Rwanda, Zimbabwe, it's 6.64. Nigeria, it's 21. In Jamaica, it's 53. All these countries have higher crime rates. Now, let me clarify. I think it's safe to say that crime is a product of poverty before it is anything else. Mm-hmm. There is nothing inherently criminal about a people or a race or a country. But when you import people from societies which have higher crime rates, who come from much poorer areas, and they're brought into the UK to do very poorly paid jobs. I haven't got the statistics to hand here, but between 2011, the census of 2011 and 2021, you could see that the very most menial labour jobs in the UK were overwhelmingly being met. Those labour positions, those job positions, were being met by new immigrants. So they're not coming into this country and suddenly kind of falling into the lap of luxury. They're going into the very kind of the poorer sections of this society. When immigration is very, very high as well, I believe this is again is this is a this is something that I believe. It's not something which I can prove through facts, but when you have lower levels of immigration, immigrants are more likely to integrate into the society they come into. When you have large numbers, and if you've got something like the size of the city of Glasgow coming to the UK every year, that is by definition a huge number. Those immigrants are quite naturally going to form ghettos. They're going to stay in their own kind. They're going to stay with people whose language they speak, whose religion they share, whose culture they belong to, whose habits of behavior, whose sexual politics, everything, the whole thing, they're more likely to do that. And that, I think, creates social problems. This is not only a problem, crime is not only a problem of the people coming in, it's how they meet up with the people already are there. It creates alienation on both sides, I think. You know, I shouldn't remind people who are listening in, I'm an immigrant myself, I'm living in Hong Kong. Now, I'm definitely not down the bottom of the economic scale there. I've got a fairly easy life. But I find it's quite an alienating experience being amongst people whose language you don't speak and so on. It creates problems on both sides. When you've got the size of a city of Glasgow coming into a country with only 68 million people, that is not sustainable if you're thinking about integrating those people into the country. It's going to create ghettos. It's going to create isolated communities on both sides, I believe. And I think a lot of what's been happening in the UK over the last few weeks, if it was an isolated incident, you know, let's go back to this initial incident. It was quite an indicative incident in a way. The young man, he was 17 years old. He was actually born in Wales, but he's the son of Rwandan immigrants. So he's a second generation immigrant. I think it's safe to say that he hadn't become integrated into British values. If this was a isolated incident, I think people would say, well, what he did was obviously, you know, he's got some sort of psychological problems to do something of such violence. I mean, he stabbed 10 children and 2 adults and murdered 3 of them. Someone who does that is really kind of at the extreme of a psychological state. But the thing is, you know, you kind of alluded to it just now, this is not an isolated incident. You know, a few days before, a week or two before, a British officer was stabbed, I think, by, again, a second-generation Nigerian immigrant. There's a feeling around this country. And, you know, since then, I think over the weekend, there were sort of 10 stabbing incidents across the UK. You know, the UK hasn't been, you know, as the statistics say, we're not a violent country. We haven't had large numbers of knife crime and so on. And that's changing now. And increasingly, there's a sense, accurately or not, that there is a correspondence between the rising crime and immigration. And there are some statistics to back that up. minority ethnicities now make up 27% of the prison population of the UK, but they only make up 18% of the population itself. I won't go into the breakdown of that. In particular, the proportion of prisoners who are Muslims in this country has increased from 8% in 2002 to 18% in 2022. Wow. That's over 2.5 times their current 7% share of the population. Now, I know the political correct term is, you know, approach is to kind of deny this is any kind of relevance. But, you know, the UK is effectively in a proxy war against the Palestinian people. There's a very, very strong feelings, more than a feeling, in this country that the British government, and by extension the British people, particularly the English people, are the enemies of Islam, that they perpetrate wars of aggression. And so rightly or wrongly, again, there is an enormous, you know, sense of disagreement between these two communities. And it goes back a lot further than this. You know, that to me is a that statistic shows that there, you know, that this there is no inter, there is not an integration going on, that there is actually becoming a greater and greater divide within this nation. In fact, it's not a nation anymore. A nation goes back to the, you know, the term where you're born, NATO, but, you know, nativity or something. This is becoming a, yeah. I actually think we're being remodeled on the model of the USA, actually, which is a nation of immigrants and which has some of the highest crime levels in the world. We've also got things like, let me just have a look. In a bigger sense, the prison population of England and Wales, this is most of the UK, it's more than quadrupled between 1900 and 2018. So that's a big time scale. However, half of this increase has taken place since 1990. Between 1992 and 2012, the prison population doubled in size. And this is the period where we've had this enormous rise in immigration.
It's pretty clear. I mean, it's pretty clear. You don't have to be a rocket scientist, brain surgeon to get that connection. And obviously, the people, do we say the native people of the UK? I don't know what word you'd use.
It just simply means you're born here. I think it's an okay term.
Okay, that's all right. I don't have to say a disclaimer with that or anything. Their perception is a real, it's real. You know, what they're perceiving is real. Yet the, you know, the rhetoric, well, no, they're more than, it's more than rhetoric. The threats coming from the establishment, the law enforcement, the, you know, the Prime Minister on down, doesn't seem to take any account of that. And I guess what you've explained up till now probably tells us why. But it's, you know, it's real tough talking. I want, if you don't mind, if you take a listen to this clip, you may have heard it before, but I want to get your reaction to this because I think it says a lot.
We will guarantee a prison cell. We will make sure that those people who need to be in prison will be in prison, not necessarily in the area where they live. They may be 200-300 miles away from home, but we will guarantee people a prison cell.
With the numbers are so tight there. How can you make that guarantee?
They are tight, and that's why we've initiated Operation Early Dawn. So basically, the easiest way to describe it is one in, one out. So as people get released, we can then pick up people from police cells and take them to court, and we will triage that three times a day.
Okay, so I don't have a name or attribution for that, but he's talking tough. He's talking tough there. And I just wonder what you expect to get from saying things like that, threatening kind of in-your-face, you know, tough talking. It's a strategy that must surely be doomed to failure at some point.
Yeah, it's. I think he's a representative, isn't he, of the prison service. When Labour, we've got this brand new government, Labour came into power and it started sort of saying immediately, oh, you know, the Conservative government's been lying to us. And one of the things they, about the economy, the state of the economy, they also said, you know, our prisons are completely full and we can't operate a prison service anymore. And it announced that it was going to release a lot of prisoners early from their sentences in order to free up prison cells. And everyone was like, well, why would you do that? At the moment, they've made a statement that because so many people have been and expected to be arrested for, I guess, what you would call political acts of demonstration against their concern about, you know, the government's policy on immigration, about the government's own reaction to this, and also about their concerns or what they write online. The government has kind of explicitly said that we're going to empty jails in order to fill them up with people who dare to get out onto the streets or to dare to go online and make their views about immigration or about wider things that's going on in the country known. The interesting thing about this, there's a lot of interesting things about it, is, as you say, kind of unsustainable. It's kind of an explicit corroboration of what a lot of people have been saying about UK police forces, that they are now a political police force. They're not there to protect the British people from criminals or from crime. They're there to enact the political intentions of a government. What this guy is saying is we will let criminals go free in order to prosecute and imprison people who have disagreed with the government, who are challenging the government on its policies. Now, the government are not sort of admitting that these are political demonstrations. After the, you know, after the murders and the attacks in Southport, where these young kids, these tiny young kids, they're sort of 10, 11 years old, were murdered. And there were demonstrations across the UK. The police came down very, very strongly, and Keir Starmer announced to the nation that these were not demonstrations. These were not political demonstrations, that these are acts of criminality. So they're not actually admitting that this is sort of an exchange for political crimes for, you know, other types of crimes. But it is, you're absolutely right. What do they hope to get from releasing a statement like that? We've got a sudden wave of knifings and all sorts of crimes that are going across the UK. And because of social media, they're all over the place at the moment. And everyone's saying this is a form of two-tier policing, that why are our already overstretched police forces being used to prosecute people for what they say online when you've got people running through the streets with machetes? You know, on the very day of the Southport murders, footage was released of events going on in the very other end of England, on South End on Sea. And you had gangs of mostly black kids, kind of, you know, black young gangs, not only black, but mostly black, running around this very small kind of seaside tourist town, waving machetes. And this has become incredibly, it's become an increasingly familiar sight in the UK. Kids now are walking around with machetes and waving them, largely to each other because they're mostly gang wars. But obviously, people get caught in the crossfire.
Yep.
And when you see that, and you see that it's not being policed, and that these kids are free to run around doing this, to attack shops, to go into shops and steal, and people just stand around and watch them, this is encouraging a greater level of criminality. One of the things that happened, try to answer your question. One of the things that happened under lockdown is that more and more of government services were handed over, outsourced to large corporations, places like Serco, what's it called, G4S. A lot of the prison service in this country is run by private corporations, international outsourcing corporations, who then delegate different jobs to other corporations and so on. It's part of the privatization of the state. And I think it was back in 2021, I read about it in one of my earlier books, the government announced a series of mega prisons, as they called them, which would hold, these are vast complexes, which would hold not thousands of prisoners, but tens of thousands of prisoners. And they came up with some figures, I haven't got them to mind, I'm afraid, about the number of male prisons. It was specifically said that these were for male prisoners, and they were going to be these huge things. And people were going around and with their kind of phones and going to these places, these giant building sites, and saying, what are these for? Why do we suddenly have this expectation that we're going to have a rising criminal population, or imprisoned population anyway? I thought it was an indication of how the government was going to continue its authoritarianism, which it had shown under lockdown. I think now we've probably got a better idea of what it's going to be used for. It's going to be used for two things. It's one going to be used for the rising criminality, which seems to be one of the consequences of mass immigration, not trickles of immigration, but mass immigration, that you create these enormous tensions between the existing community and the one coming in. And let me just caveat this. The people who are living in England already, we're not all white over here. We've got a kind of a, you know, 50-year, 70-year history of immigration. And the second generation immigrants here are also concerned about rising immigration itself. So it is not, as Keir Starmer says, an act of racism. This is people who are concerned on both sides. It's about where you're living and the kind of the social fabric you're living in. I think that's one of the reasons for, but it's also there to house what appears to be and going to be an increasing population of people who dare to voice their concern about this. So it's very concerning.
It's incredible, isn't it? That's, very chilling. To end up, Simon, it's the obvious question. What gives? When does it give? How does it give? Or does it just sort of bump on like this with the tension ratcheting up endlessly? Is there a breaking point, do you think, where something gives big time?
You know, you kind of asked me, or you sort of said, is this sustainable? Is it not sustainable? You know, lockdown was, we were locked down, which is not a medical measure, for a virus with the infection fatality rate of seasonal influenza. The whole thing was a testing ground, to a certain extent, of compliance. And I think the people behind this they were amazed at the level of compliance. It's going to be more difficult to do it the second time.
Yeah.
At the moment, the World Health Organization, as I'm sure you know, has announced that monkeypox is the new pandemic, and they're telling us that we need to get vaccinated with new vaccines supplied by our good friend Bill Gates, and we need to, you know, and so surely there's going to be an attempt. Will people obey in the same numbers as before? That's the kind of question. I think this is a challenge. Are we actually going to obey this? There is, you know, every time Starmer and all these other people get up, Justin Trudeau, you haven't got, God bless you, Jacinda Ardern anymore. But every time this happens, anytime there's any opposition to governments, they describe us, the people of our country, as a small minority of unthinking thugs. They're the minority. Keir Starmer has a minority government, 20% of the vote. And the people he's representing, he's not really representing them, but who've given him his, under our weird system, a mandate, they are an extremist minority. They believe in the orthodoxies of transsexualism. They believe that one of the most authoritarian and undemocratic and corrupt governments in the world, that is the Ukraine, is somehow a bastion of democracy against Russia. These people hold extremist views, and it's those who are the danger to us. But the real danger, let me say this, is not from immigrants coming into our country. The real danger is from the corporations who are throwing large numbers of people without any concern for the consequences into our countries. I think we have to remind ourselves that we are the majority. The Starmer government has no mandate to do anything at all. I very, very much hope that one way or another, and I can't discuss the ways, but there are lots of ways, that we bring this government down. Because at the moment, in a very short period of time, he's only been in office for, a couple of months. He's rapidly become one of the most unpopular politicians in the history of this country. And we, instead of accepting and being bullied into threats by these very, very ambiguous laws and a politicization both of our police and our courts, very explicitly, we should try to remind our government and the people of Britain that we still nominally live in a democracy, that there is a rule of law here, that the courts and the police are not under the direction of our government, but are there to enact the laws of the land. And under those laws, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights makes it a defended right to have opinions about politics or anything else and to transmit them through various forms of media. So the law is still just about on our side. And we have to remind ourselves that it is on our side, that we are the majority. But unfortunately, a political coup has been perpetrated on the UK. And we're now being ruled by a highly authoritarian, and I would say, with going on from Orwell, a fascistic leader of an authoritarian government who is undoubtedly using the legitimate concerns of the British people to implement the rollout of facial recognition by the police, of digital identity as a requirement to go online. And we've even had people in the members of the House of Lords, another unelected body, calling for lockdowns whenever there's any threat of civil disturbance in the country. These are the forerunners of fascism. These are the programs and legislation of fascism. And we need to stand up to it.
Wow. That time went quick. Thank you, Simon Elmer, for giving us such an incredible overview that we've been missing here. I mean, many people have already dialed into the podcast you've been on and the posts and all that sort of stuff. But to hear it like we've just heard it, it's been great. So thanks for taking the time to join us again on our radio station.
Thank you for having me, Paul. It's very important, you know, because our media is not doing its job. It's very important that, you know, people like you, there's a lot of people around the, start forming their own media. You know, we have to form our own governments and we need a media to do that because the current media that we've got is completely, you know, it's completely controlled and it's abnegating its responsibility. You know, these figures, this data that I've related, it should be known by the British people. There's no reason it shouldn't be. The data has been produced by the British government and the people have the right to see that data. So thank you for giving me the small opportunity to relate some of this and to corroborate that the concerns of the British people as people across the West are not racist concerns. They're not a small minority. These are genuine concerns which have a reality in the countries that we're living in.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.